This is Kim Taylor, June 13th, interviewing Philip Davis on his career as a smoke jumper. How did you get interested in smoke jumping?
Oh, in 1947, several of us started off to drive to Alaska, and we got up into Canada, and our car was giving us too much trouble, so we came back to Kalispell, and we're looking around for something to do for the summer, and we got a job out on Coram District of the Flathead, where we just spent the summer working on district, and the foreman that we worked for most of the summer up there had a son in the smoke jumpers, so he talked a lot about the jumpers. And I knew a little bit about them because one of my older brothers had worked here in Missoula on a Forest Service project where they were stationed out at Nine Mile, so they were living right with the jumpers off and on, so he knew quite a bit about the jumpers. I suppose those two things probably made me apply.
What was it that you were doing before you had got this job on the Flathead?
I had just gotten out of the service. When I got out of high school, I went to college for about two quarters and got drafted, and was in the service for a couple of years during World War II. And then I got out in 46, I guess. Yeah, 46 I got out. And in the spring of 47, I started back to college. That was about it. From then on, I was either working for the Forest Service or going to school until I graduated.
And what kind of work was it that you were doing on the Flathead?
Well, we started out as just a brush crew. They had to pile brush behind where the loggers had cut in there, and we started out on that. That was probably the main thing we did during the summer. However, we did work a few trails and went on a few fires and normal district work. But primarily, we were just piling brush.
What kind of prestige and reputation did smoke jumpers have? How did the project crew perceive them?
Oh, I never heard much one way or the other. The foreman that had a son out here in the jumpers, in fact, his son was one of the, I got to know very well later, and he was one of the boys killed at Man Gulch. Of course, he was really proud. He thought the jumpers were the greatest thing, and his son in the jumpers was just about the greatest thing in the world, which kind of gave it a pretty good boost. And they did, right towards the end of the summer, they had a pretty big fire on Flathead in which quite a number of jumpers came up and jumped. Twice too many, I know that. I don't know what they had all sorts of problems and lost their gear and couldn't find the fire, and you know, it was a great big mess. But that didn't deter me.
So how did you go about applying for the smoke jumper job?
There were three of us. During the next year, we were all back in school. I went to Montana State, and we were all back in school, and three of us got my brother, my next older brother, and myself, and another fellow who had worked on Coram District on the Flathead the summer before. We were all living together there. And I guess we just got to talking it over, so we filled out an application. That was it. Filled out an application and got hired. They must have been short or something, because none of us really had the background for it. I guess we had all worked one summer for the Forest Service, but that was all. We didn't have any extensive background that would have gotten us a job fast.
Well, what did the training entail? when she got hired on as a smoke jumper?
Oh, we went out. We came over here right after school was out in the spring. They started the new jumper group about a week after college was out, and after the end of spring quarter, say. And they had, gosh, I don't really remember how long, but we started out with a lot of physical training, just like the Army, as far as that goes, too, because you had to be in good shape. And then the specialized training that you had, as far as learning how to land and how to make letdowns out of trees and that, they had certain periods of the day allocated to lectures and this sort of thing on that. They had a lot of stuff on map reading and how to measure fires, because you had to turn in a fire report. Just things, just exactly what you needed to know and nothing more. And this went on till, I don't really remember how many weeks it was, but we started, I suppose, about the 10th of June or thereabouts, and I would think that we were about done with our training, our accelerated training, I guess you'd say, where that's all you did, by maybe about a month later, maybe the 10th or 15th of July. That year, that was 1948, that particular year, it was just like this. It just rained and rained and rained. There were no fires. It was sort of for nothing that first year.
Was that disappointing to you?
Oh, yeah. We had a good time. We had a good job anyway. It was a real good job, even though it was a very poor fire year. Or good, depending on whether you were wanting to fight fire or save the forest.
What was your first training jump like?
Oh, it wasn't anything spectacular, I guess. You spent so much time going out of mock-ups and doing dry runs on everything that when you actually did it, it was kind of anticlimactic. You pretty much did it by reflex action. To me, I guess it was a little more. I'd never even been up in an airplane. I'd never been off the ground. And the first time I ever went up, I jumped out. As a matter of fact, I guess I took off in an airplane 8 times before I ever landed in one. Because every time you went up, you jumped. So I didn't know what it was to come down in an airplane. And all I'd ever done was take off.
How about your first fire jump?
It was just a two-man fire. And it was over on the Nisbers in Idaho. I guess I should ask, we filled out a thing for the 10-page thing for the jumpers. Did you read that at all? That thing that just for this oral history project, they sent out a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. Some of the things like that question right there you asked, they asked too, so I didn't know whether I was repeating or what here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a two-man fire and it was just before dark. Over, and it was over south of Castle Creek on the Nisbers. And when we got there, when they had turned the fire call in, it was just a little fire, I guess. Boy, when we got there, it was big. It was way too big for two men. It was kind of stupid to even jump on it because it was about a 15 or 16 man fire when we got there. But we went ahead and jumped, just the two of us. And it was too late for them to get anybody else, because it was dark and you couldn't jump after dark. It was just, we jumped just as it was starting to get dark, or just before it got dark. But things turned out very well. The two of us took off up on the point. One of us started down each side. One thing I'll say, the training was really good, the fire training. You knew just about exactly what to do. even though none of us had really ever fought very much fire, actual firefighting, the training was really good. So we knew just about exactly what to do and just about exactly what to expect, and we knew just about when the wind was going to change from going uphill to downhill, and as it turned out, we got it, just the two of us. By morning, we had it. We worked all night. And that was about it. Oh, there were a few things. When we jumped, our fire packs hung up. There was a bunch of lodgepole there, and our fire packs hung way up in the air. No way you could get them. So I signaled for some climbers. We had streamer signals that you could signal what you wanted back to the airplane. And I put out the signal for some climbers so I could climb up the lodgepole and get a Pulaski out of a pack so I could cut the tree down and get the chute and the packs and stuff. See, the Pulaskis were in the fire packs. And we didn't even have any means of cutting the tree down to get our packs down. So I wanted a pair of climbers to go up and get a Pulaski so I could cut the tree down.
And what exactly are the climbers?
Just regular like pole climbers that like the power line people use, the telephone people, just things you strap on your feet so you can climb up a tree. Because on a lodgepole there aren't any limbs down below, so you can climb them like you go out here and climb a tree like that. It's just like climbing a telephone pole, and you about have to have something to get up. And they did. Had a thing I always remember on that. The fellow who was spotting us, after they dropped the second jumper, well, they circled around, you know, until we got up, see if we were okay, I guess. And I went up and put out my streamers to signal for the climbers, which I'd said before. And in the meantime, they came over and threw out a 5-gallon can of water with a little cargo chute on it. And when it came down, it went into some brush and punched a hole in the side of the can. And I looked down there and the water was spurting out of the can. That was gonna be our drinking water. So I ran down to tip the can over and get the hole so that we wouldn't lose all our drinking water. And totally forgot I'd signaled for the climbers. And I ran down there and stooped over it and tipped the can over so that all our water wasn't running out through the hole that was punched in it. And I heard the plane coming over, and I looked up, and boy, he was just over the treetops. And the spotter leaned up and threw the climbers. He was just right there. I suppose he wasn't. He was probably 300-400 feet high, was all. But you could see the spotter standing in the door of the plane. And just as I looked up, I saw him lean out and let fly with those. And they didn't have any parachute on them. They just had a streamer hooked to them so you could find them. Boy, they were just coming right straight at me. Like I could just see it. And I jumped up and stood behind a lodgepole. Boy, that was the thinnest I ever was. Because that lodgepole wasn't as big as I was. And those dang climbers hit the tree right over my head on the other side. Not big. Hunk halfway out of through the tree on the far side. If they'd hit me in the head, it'd have killed me, it's out of doubt, you know, or hit me anywhere, they'd have gone right through me. That was the one thing I remember mainly about that fire. That was my first fire job. After that, I had sense enough to not run down where they were throwing stuff out.
Okay, when you didn't, when there weren't any fires, were you doing project work?
Yeah, most of the time. Depended on, they had a fire list. And at that time, I don't know whether this went for a long time, but at least during those years, you didn't keep everybody in to jump all the time. It depended a lot on the fire season, whether it was real hot or not hot or what, and you'd pull people in off project to either out at 9 Mile or down here at the loft at Hale Field, which is right down here where St. Louis School is now. and then you would make usually two jumps, going two fires. You'd go out on a fire and come back and go out on another fire before they sent you back out on project again. So they kept rotating all the men through all the time. Then if the fire season got really hot, it ended up with all of the men being in, because you were all going just as fast as you could come in if it was a real hot fire season. But throughout the early part of the summer, or in a year like in, say, 1948, they had to keep a crew down here ready to go, but there were so few fires that there wasn't much to do. So, to get back to your question, I guess, if you weren't out on project, why, there were things to do. If you were here in town on fire call here at Hale Field, that you had to be within a certain number of minutes, I forget, of the airport. So we used to go up Paddy Canyon here and work in the campground, cut wood and clear timber and clean them up. We sometimes worked around the parachute loft, making up fire packs, this sort of thing. If you were out at 9 Mile on standby, there were quite a few things to do. You didn't have to be quite so close out there, so there were a lot of things to do. There was always building maintenance, and wood to get, trees to cut. There was always something to do, even if you weren't on project.
So did you go back and forth between the Missoula and the 9 Mile base?
Yeah. You see, we had a little airstrip out there. In fact, we built it must have been between 48 and 49. The strip is still out there, just west of the old Remont station out there. I don't know if they use it anymore or not, but towards the end of 1949, we were using that strip some. But generally speaking, we flew out of Hale Field right here, right where the VOTEC is.
So it just depended on whichever one you were closest to?
Well, generally, during the time I was there, we jumped out of here. So if they had enough crew here at this one to supply the needs, there was usually somebody living right down here. And then you sort of filled the needs here in town from out at 9 Mile, because you had the facilities out there to handle many more people. The setup down here was pretty small. They just had a little mess hall and a small kitchen, and the sleeping quarters were, a little building still down there. Well, it wasn't any bigger than this house. You couldn't handle very many people.
Mm-hmm.
So they just kind of fed the Hale Field complex from the 9 Mile, and got pretty thick down here when you got a real hot period of forest fires, towards the end of August in 1949, everybody was on fire all the time, and the whole crew was just feeding in and out of Hale Field down here. Sometimes there were an awful lot of people there to be handled by the little mess hall they had, small kitchen facilities just weren't hardly big enough to handle the big crews. But they always had the 9 Mile base as backup in case they got into problem.
Do you remember any interesting individuals that worked with you?
If you were a smoke jumper, you were an interesting individual. I think it attracted the people that liked a good time, wanted to do something interesting. I don't really remember anybody that wasn't an interesting individual. People all had good stories to tell, and they were fun to work with. Really was a pretty high caliber of a crew. A lot higher caliber crew than I ever worked with, say, on district, because Of course, at that time, almost the whole crew were college kids. The majority were going to either here at the university or over at Montana State. There were, of course, quite a few from the east, but almost all of them were students. But we're just out here for the summer jumping. But I think just the nature of the job, if a guy didn't want to work hard, he didn't apply in the first place. And so you had a pretty high caliber crew. It was fun to, when you went on project with a bunch of the jumpers, you really got things done. You had guys that really would work. There weren't any slackers. They were good workers and pretty sharp people, I thought. Maybe I wouldn't if I looked at them now.
Are there any of those characters that stand out in your mind?
A few, but mainly ones that you've seen a lot since then. The ones that have stayed around here. And there are people here in Missoula that, just like me, are still here. We were out there then and see them. I guess there was no particular individual I can think of, but I remember more than any of the others. Some of them you really didn't get to know very well, especially after the first year. On the first year you trained with everybody of the new people, and you got to know all of the people that were new hirees on the year that you were a new hiree. You got to know them really well. But after that, usually you were gone by the time the new crew started and out on project somewhere, and so then you only met isolated individuals if you happened to go on a fire with them or something. And so those that were older timers than a lot of them you never got to know very well, and those that were newer than a lot of them you didn't get to know, because you just didn't work together and you didn't train together. Like the second year when you came back, you had to go through some refresher training, but it was not with the new hirees. And as I recall, it was started earlier than the new hirees, so usually by the time the new hirees started their first year training, you were already gone. You'd have finished your refresher training and gone off on a project or something, so you didn't really get to know them.
How do they match up people for jumps?
Other than on a bigger fire where you had to have somebody in, like say an 8-man fire or something, they always of course tried to get an experienced person, a squad leader, somebody who'd been around a while, fought quite a little fire, to go to be sort of in charge of the crew. Other than that, they just had a jump list. To start out with, it was somewhat alphabetical, just because you trained. When you were in training, they broke you up into squads just purely by your alphabetic position of your name. I can still remember all the names on both sides of me just from calling roll and this sort of thing. And it was just the alphabetic, just right down the alphabet. But the overhead people in the office made up the jump list, and I guess I don't quite know how they arrived at it. Like on later years, when you weren't in an alphabetical group of any kind, I know that the people that I was on fires with were not anywhere near me alphabetically, so I think they just made up a roster of the people depending on who was there, or went down it and got those that were the closest, or something like that. It was pretty fair. You got no one person got a lot more jumps than anybody else. I mean, they didn't have some people getting 10 jumps a summer and others getting 2. They were pretty well evened out over the whole crew. Other than the crew that went to New Mexico, they always got a lot of jumps, because down there they get so many more fires than they do up here. that didn't count because they were sort of a separate crew anyway. They left and went down there way earlier in the year.
How were they chosen to go down there?
If they applied for it. I don't really know if they had, if there were more applied than they had room for. It wasn't really a very big crew that went down there. I never did go. My next door brother went down there 2 years. But they went down way earlier. And usually, in fact, they left here to go to New Mexico before school was, before spring quarter was over. So any of us that were seriously going to college couldn't go because you had to leave before the end of spring quarter. And so that's the reason I never did go. I think that generally the New Mexico crew was made up of guys that weren't going to school, or at least not very seriously. They preferred going to New Mexico to go out to school spring quarter or something like that. I know that was the case with my brother. He'd usually go to school fall and winter quarter, and then spring quarter he'd drop out so he could jump into New Mexico. Made pretty good money down there, better than we did up here, because they got so many more fire jobs. And your money was, at that time, it was overtime. You got regular time and then overtime. And of course, when you go on fires, you get lots of overtime because you work all night, and walk out at night, and everything. So fires mean a lot of money, or did then. I don't know how they operated up there.
Can you give us a kind of a idea of what a standard fire, what your duties were to put it out?
Well, most of the fires that the jumpers went on, I just say most because there were big fires, but by and large, the fires were small fires. That was the purpose of the jumpers, was to fly in and get them while they were still little before they blew up out of control. I was never on a fire as a jumper that was, I mean, where we went in and jumped in on it, that was more than a four-man fire. So they were pretty small. So I'll speak only of the little ones like that. But you went in and, well, the average fire you were on was really, a lightning strike was about what it amounted to, and that depended. If it hit a tree, it might be where the tree went down. I went on one that wasn't 20 feet across. I had it out in 10 minutes. You know, it would have gone out if I had never jumped, but you don't know that. Depending on the conditions, of course, they could blow up awful fast, but when you'd go in, you'd get your fire packs down, and then you'd just start digging a fire line around the fire to get it so it couldn't run. And once you got it encircled with a fire line so it wouldn't run in the duff and branches and stuff on the ground, then you just started what we called mopping it up, and you just went in from your fire line going in making your line bigger and putting out. Usually the middle was already burned out anyway, other than some stumps and logs and stuff. So once you had it completely under control, you still had to stay around until it was completely out, unless you were relieved. Occasionally there'd be some district people would walk in, and when they got there, then they usually relieved you, and they'd go ahead and do the mop up and put out the burning stumps and stuff like that. So you could start walking out and get back to go on something that was more important, I guess you'd say, than that one. So you go ahead and mop them up, and if nobody came in, why, you'd, when they were completely out to your satisfaction, why, you'd gather up your stuff, and you had a choice. We weren't required to carry our gear out. You didn't have all that much gear. You had a fire pack and a parachute, and sometimes they'd throw in other things like a two-man saw or something like that. You were supposed to take your gear to the nearest trail or the nearest point where it could be positively identified where it was and leave it for one of the district packers to pick up and take out, if you wanted to. I don't think I ever did. Actually, you have, it's kind of dumb to leave it laying out there and make a packer go all the way in after it when you can easily carry it out. The amount of weight is nothing. Usually by the time you go out, your food's about depleted anyway, so what do you have? Just a couple of parachutes and Pulaski and a shovel. So we generally just carried everything out. A couple of times, a packer came in and got there while we were still on the fire. And so then we didn't have to carry anything out because he was there before we ever left. And we just helped him load the stuff up. Let him take it, and we walked out.
Well, you mentioned when you were almost out of food, so I'm real curious, what kind of food did they send you out with?
It was good. They had rations and that were all pre-packed. They were, depending on what kind of a fire it was, they were somewhat like the World War II sea rations, which I was plenty familiar with, having just gotten out of the service. But I didn't mind them. I never was touchy about what I ate. It was good food. And they had a lot of things, like on bigger fires, they'd throw out boxed rations that had canned ham, this sort of canned stuff. Never any fresh food of any kind. But really, as a jumper, you're never on a fire very long. Because the whole purpose of the jumpers was to go in and get them while they were little. And if they got very big, by then the district people got there and it wasn't your fire anymore anyway. So whether you got it under control or didn't get it under control, you were off of it in just a day or so. Very seldom were you ever on a fire more than a day or 2 days. Because just the way, that's the way it was. You either got it out and left or somebody came in and relieved you. Your function was just a sort of an assault force to go in and get it quick. So you really weren't there long enough to have to worry very much about rations. A person could have easily gone in for the length of time you were there without any rations at all, because it's nice to have them. And I know there'd have been a lot of complaint, but person could have survived easily for the day or day and a half you were going to be in there without any rations. So it wasn't a thing you worried about. Rations were good. You had good food on fires. Well, one we did.
You want to tell us about that?
Well, this was after, I don't remember which fire it was, but they'd had a big project fire someplace, where they threw out huge rations that came in big boxes, big wooden boxes. And after the fire, somebody had gone around and picked up all the stuff that wasn't used and thrown it back in one of the boxes and nailed the lid back on it again. And somehow when that box came back into the jumper center, like, they thought it had never been opened, so they just put it right back on the line with the rations. And we went over into Idaho on a fire. It was supposed to be an 8-man fire. 8 of us went over, but when we got there, it was too small, and so only 4 of us jumped. But all the rations they had were the big rations, and so they pushed this big 8-man box out for us because that was all there was. And we went and put the fire out. It was a pretty easy fire, and we put it out and decided it was time to go eat. And we went out and took a Pulaski and ripped the top off of that box. What was in it was about 20 pounds of coffee, and I bet there must have been 60 cans of condensed milk, and really nothing else. I remember there was one little can of canned potatoes, which we shared. A lot of sugar, I remember that. I don't remember how many pounds of sugar, but all it was just junk that hadn't been used from the previous fire. So we drank a lot of coffee. They'd thrown water into us, and we took a 5-gallon can, one of these square 5-gallon cans, cut the end out of it and set it on a burning stove that was out in the middle of the fire. Filled it about half full of water and dumped about 2 pounds of coffee in it. We'd go over and dip our canteen cups in that and dump a can of condensed milk and a bunch of sugar in it and drink it. We were on that one for about a day and a half, and that's really all we had was very rich coffee. Mostly condensed milk and sugar. But that was really the only time we didn't have good rations, and that was pretty funny.
Well, at that time, they didn't rely on radio contact like they do now.
They had radios, but we sure didn't use them much. They weren't really very satisfactory. Usually that was before transistors, and so all the radio gear was hot cathode tubes, and when you throw one of them out of a plane, it seemed like they very seldom ever worked. They just wouldn't stand the banging around. But nowadays, it'd work fine. I bet everybody could carry a little walkie-talkie now because they're sturdy and light. But they did have radios, but I never had one on the fire. I don't believe I ever used one. We went through the use of them, how to set them up, in training, but I never did ever use one. Never was on a fire where they had radios. So they weren't really that important to us. I think they were especially good if maybe there'd been an injury or something like that. They probably would have thrown a radio out so that you could have given and taken instructions and so forth to somebody. There were very few injuries.
Were there ever any injuries while you were a smoke jumper?
Not in any crew I was on. Never even a sprained ankle or anything. Pretty safe, really. But the main thing that is apt to happen are maybe scratches from coming down through the trees, or possibly a sprained ankle or something, or maybe a broken finger from where you had your fingers through the shroud lines. And that was not an uncommon thing at all, to have somebody break or strain a finger real bad, because you're usually fighting to get into a little clearing as you're coming down, and you'll have your hands up in your riser just planing and pulling, trying to get, 30 feet farther to get to miss a tree or something. And if that chute happens to catch on a limb or something, and you're pulling down here, why, it just pops your hand back, just whang your finger, because you have your fingers hooked right in the shroud lines. And so finger injuries were kind of common, but nothing serious. Sore fingers.
Were you aware of any social prejudices?
I don't think so. Well, for one thing, I was only about 23 years old, I guess, and I didn't really think much about that sort of thing then. But I don't think there was really anything. Maybe we just didn't think about it. We were concerned with other things, I guess. We just didn't worry much about prejudices.
But in terms of the guys on the cruise, it wasn't evident at all.
Not at all, that I know of. There may have been, but there sure wasn't where I was. Between the district people and the jumpers, there was, I think, in certain cases, maybe a little ill feeling between certain district people and certain jumpers, because maybe some of the jumpers thought they were a little elite, or maybe maybe the district people thought they were a bunch of knotheads or something. But even there, I never ran into much of that anywhere where I was.
What were some of your off-duty activities during training?
Not very much, really. we did all our training out at Nine Mile. And of course, some of the people had cars, but a lot of us didn't. I didn't ever have a car when I was out there. So you couldn't just jump in your car and come into Missoula or something like that. Or there were, you probably could get in if you wanted to. But I think that maybe a little bit of it was the group you associated with. The bunch that I associated with were pretty much just a bunch of college kids that were trying to make enough money to go back to school one more year. And so you didn't really go out and whoop it up much. When you were off duty, well, you pretty much just played around and read. That's about it. Played around and read. But I suppose there were some. I know there were some of the guys out there that were a lot bigger partiers, and they usually found a way to get to town or something for the weekend. But the group that I was with did. We were pretty quiet. We were good kids.
So during the off season, you went back to school.
Oh yeah. Went back. Anytime I wasn't jumping, I was gone to college.
And you would work with the smoke jumpers
just through the summer. One fall, I didn't go back fall quarter. When the jumper season ended, we were working on a project way up south of Summit, surveying, and the job was going to keep right on going, and we were making pretty good money. It was my brother and I, and a couple more of the guys were up there surveying. And we were still drawing jumper wage, which was a good deal better than just a rod man on a survey crew. And they were willing to keep us on, so we didn't go back to school fall quarter. We hadn't made that much money ever. And so we just stayed on and surveyed. Clearly the snow got so deep we couldn't anymore, which was about 1st of November. And we had to quit then. There wasn't any more jobs, so we had to terminate. But, that's about it, as far as that goes.
What were some of the planes that you would jump from?
At the time that I was jumping here and out of Missoula, they only used 3 different kinds of planes. They had the old Curtis Travel Airs, which were about a 1927 vintage. That was the littlest ones. And we took those if we just had a 2-man fire. If you had anything much bigger, we used the Ford Trimotors. That was what was used, I suppose, more than anything, because that fit the size of the jump crews that were going out more than anything. And they were real good. They were awfully slow. Took an awful long time to get to a fire because their top speed was slower than most people drive their cars. And then they had the old C-47s or DC-3s, I guess they called them. It was the Army C-47 from World War II. And they had a couple of those out there that I guess I never did jump out of on a fire. I jumped out of them in training jumps, but I was never on a fire where we used a C-47. They were okay. Got there fast. And they used the C-47s a lot for moving guys around. Like if you had a crew that was going from here to Grangeville or something to work on a project, they'd usually just fly you over. And they were a good transport plane.
Did you have a favorite plane?
Oh, I suppose the old Trimotors were the best. They were slow and easy, no wind blast when you jumped out of them. Easy to get out of. They were okay. I don't think there was really any great favoritism. The old Trimotors were antiques even then, and so you had a big place in your heart for the this old workhorse that was still out there pounding away. Yeah, even in even in 1948, the Trimotors were old, old planes. And so were the Travelers, as far as I'm concerned. Down in New Mexico, they used little different planes, somewhat. They had a Canadian, they call it a Nordane. They jumped out of a lot, which was a small plane, about like a Traveler, maybe a little bigger than a Traveler. But I never did jump out of it. And I guess that's all they used. We didn't have anything other than those at the time I was there. They'd come pick you up occasionally in a different plane. When if you walked out, say, to Orofino or somewhere, why, they might pick you up with a different plane. But the planes that were geared up for jumping, that you could take the door off and had a place to hook your static line and so forth, were those three planes. I do think it's kind of nice to have had the experience to know exactly how to go about flying fire, or at least a way to go about fighting fire.
Has that been a help for you since you were a smoke jumper?
Oh, sure. I've been in two or three places where somebody's campfire would start to run or something like that, and they'd pitiful, I tell you. You'd think their common sense would tell them more what to do, you know. They'll run around and start trying to stamp on them, things like this. Yeah. I think you don't realize how much you learned about fighting fire in the forest service. Things, they just seem second nature now, but I guess you didn't really, or some people didn't. I'd grown up over in the central part of the state out on a ranch, and we'd always had prairie fires and stuff to fight, so we pretty well knew how to go about putting a fire out before I ever went to the jungle. I'm sure some of these people came from the east, and this really did require fire training.
Can you describe a typical jump?
Typical fire jump?
Yeah.
Isn't really too much to them. It's just a means of getting to the fire. We'd be, say out here, if you were on standby here at Hale Field, why, very often the calls would come in during the night, because most of the lightning storms come across late in the afternoon. They still do. It wasn't any different then. And so the fires would flare up and get reported in the evening or during the night when it was too late to for anybody to jump that night. So that a lot of times you'd get called out way early in the morning. It might be 3 o'clock in the morning. They'd want to start, get out, get your gear together, because there'd have been 15 fires called in during the night, and you would want to get on them right at daylight if you possibly could. So I'd say that was a real common thing, was to get rousted out during the night, and you'd get up and usually eat a big breakfast. They'd roust the cook out and eat a big breakfast and get on a plane just about daylight, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that, when it's starting to get daylight in the summertime. You didn't really have to worry too much about getting your gear on the plane. They usually had that all lined up anyway. That was usually on before you ever got there, but you always checked to make sure everything was there that you needed. And the overhead people always worried about all the rations and the fire packs and this, so you didn't really have to worry about that, other than you always did. You always checked it to make sure that there was stuff there. And a couple of times, I remember, you were all ready to go and loaded up in the plane when it was still too dark to take off. We were flying out of Hale Field down here, and there were no runway lights or anything. It had to be daylight before they would take off. And so I remember sitting down here. Well, I suppose the one runway, this end of it must have been about where the Mormon Church is down here on Bancroft, along in there somewhere. And they'd taxi out there, and you'd sit there and wait till it got daylight enough to take off, which might be 15, 20, 30 minutes, just sit there waiting till the pilot felt that it was okay to take off. And then you'd fly. You usually knew where you were going, because before you ever left, you got a map with the location of the fire on. You had to have that so you knew where you were and so you knew where to walk out to when you got done. So you knew where you were going. You'd fly wherever it was. Out of Missoula here, there wasn't hardly anywhere that was more than an hour or two away. But we jumped on around here. An hour or two, even in a Ford trimotor, was 150 miles, and we didn't really go much more than 150 mile radius. I guess there were a few. But most of the fires in Region 1 here were, I'd say, within 150 miles of Missoula. So you really weren't on the plane all that long. And then you'd go out. And I guess when you decided who was going to jump first was probably how you happened to sit down in the plane. I don't know. Just the guy closest to the door got up and hooked up when it came time. And the spotter, of course, they'd make a pass over the area, and he'd locate a spot that he thought was a safe place to jump into. And then he'd direct the pilot to fly over it, and he'd throw out a little drift chute so that you could measure how much wind drift there was. And then usually on about the next pass over the fire, why, they'd compensate for the wind. And by then, the first guy would be out on the step ready to go. Depended on, usually, if it was just, say, a two-man fire, you just jumped one guy at a time. One guy would get out and jump, and then they'd make another circle in the second and go. If it was out of a trimotor or one of the C-47s, you jumped more than two, three guys at a time, two guys anyway, out of a trimotor, and we jumped, practice jumping, we jumped five at a time out of the C-47s. But the more people you have jump, I'm getting away from your question.
That's okay.
The more people you have jump at one pass, the more spread out you get. And if you happen to be a little bit late coming out of the plane, happened to be the fifth guy, you might be a long ways from the fire because that plane's moving along pretty fast up there. And if you're up in pretty rugged country, well, you might have a two-hour walk from where you landed to get back to where you were where you were jumping. And so there's a definite advantage in just jumping one or two at a time because they're coming out right on the spot you want them. Then, to get back to your question, of course, when you get down, you generally don't worry much about your parachute since the fire is the main thing. And you just leave it hanging up, whatever, if it's hanging up, if you happen to come in where there's enough timber that it's all snagged up in a tree. So you'd get your pack, if you could, your fire pack, so you had your tools and head off on the fire. And if it was where somebody happened to be in charge, fired, say, eight people, so there was somebody that was directing operations, where he'd make up his mind what to do and just tell you what to do. And you pretty much worked, well, I won't say individually, you worked depending on the situation where you were. Maybe you'd all want to work right in one line, right around one side of a fire, if it happened to be running that way. If it was not running much, well, you'd usually split up, and a couple of you go on one side, and a couple on the other, wherever it looked like the dangerous spots were, and work together. I would say there really wasn't much as far as having a big foreman that directed activities and that. No, even though there was somebody in charge, it was pretty much decided by the group. You know, when think we'd ought to go over here and do this? And another one saying, well, yeah, maybe so, but don't you think we'd ought to get somebody up there? And finally you'd just agree about how to do it. You'd go ahead and do it. Nobody ever cared too much. But I'm sure this wasn't the case on bigger fires, which I never really got on, so I don't really know. I'm sure that when you get a 16 or a 32-man fire, you have to have a chain of command and somebody directing activities. But I really, in the jumpers, never got on that kind of fire. I did out of the jumper, not in the jumpers.
What was your most memorable jump?
Well, I'd say the most memorable, I think, just because so many strange things happened, was one up in Glacier Park. It just wasn't like the usual jump. It was way high. I don't know. St. Nicholas is a real Matterhorn-type peak down in the south end of Glacier Park, Mount St. Nicholas. And I had looked at it all the summer when I worked on Flathead Forest, because I'd done a little mountain climbing and it interested me, and I really wanted to try and climb St. Nicholas someday. And we happened to be on project that summer up working at West Glacier. And so when they got the fire call to save time, they were getting a little short of jumpers here in Missoula. They just gathered up our gear and put it on a plane and flew the plane to Kalispell, and we drove down from West Glacier to Kalispell, so that it saved us coming all the way to Missoula, getting on a plane and flying all the way back to Glacier Park. They just came up and met us in Kalispell. So we went up, it was just a little two-man fire, and it was way up on St. Nicholas. It was right in the very top of the timber on Mount St. Nicholas. And I was pretty excited about that, because I wanted to see St. Nicholas from the air. I wanted to from right on top, see what it looked like, to see if it was possible for an amateur like me to climb it. So when we got there, I really wasn't paying any attention to anything, because I was trying to see St. Nicholas. And when we circled over the fire, we were probably 700-800 feet above the fire. We had to jump off a low because the wind was blowing, and we were at really high altitude. So when we made our pass over the fire for the spotter to throw out his drift chute and so forth, why, we were right on the level of the top of St. Nicholas, and we were right there. I could have thrown a rock out of the plane and made it land on the top of St. Nicholas. We were just, the Matterhorn spire was just off the tip of the wing, and we were flying right. Boy, that was exciting. But anyway, we went over and I jumped first. The fire was really small. And I jumped first and was really lucky for the, it was windy and hot, and I came right on the edge of the fire. When I hung up in a tree, but my feet were touching the ground. And I hung up in a tree right, well, in fact, I was so close to the edge of the fire that if it had flared up, it would have burned my parachute. I was that close to it, but the fire didn't amount to anything. It would have gone out if we had never jumped. The other fella came around, and he jumped, same place I did, but he got caught in a cross draft. And he went over it, and just before he hit, he went over a cliff, which dropped off into it. He hadn't touched the ground yet, so the minute he went over the cliff, of course, he was 1,000 feet in the air again, out over the canyon. And he went on, disappeared from my view, but I knew he was okay. He was coming down all right. When he landed, he was probably, he must have been at least a mile from the fire and way, way below it, down in a canyon underneath these towering cliffs. So I went ahead, but to back up a minute, when I landed, one of the things that made it unique was when I landed, I came down and I hung up in a tree and bounced a little bit, but my feet were touching the ground. I was kind of just setting yet in my harness, and I had landed right in the middle of a whole bunch of little weasels. Just baby weasels, like, I don't know how many there were, but they had absolutely no fear of me. And they'd run right over my shoes. You could reach down and pick them up, and they were, there must have been at least a half a dozen of them. And that just, I couldn't believe it. It just didn't seem real to me. And this was, they could have never seen a human before. It was halfway up the side of Mount St. Nicholas up in Glacier Park. They'd never seen a human, I know. But that was all kind of funny. But anyway, I got out of my chute and went over and put the fire out before the other fellow ever got there. I had the fire completely out. It wasn't big enough to jump on anyway. And it took about 30 minutes to put every spark out. So along in the evening, he finally came walking in. Anyway, at that time, we decided to stay all night. It was dark by then. And we were testing out some sleeping bags that they were trying out in the jumpers, and they were made out of brown paper, just like a great big paper bag that was laminated, several layers of paper laminated together with tar. And the things were really pretty good. The idea was that they were disposable. You didn't bother to carry them out. They'd burn. You used them one time and threw them away. But they had a problem, and they were really slick. They were just, if there was any slope to the mountainside at all, they'd go just like a toboggan. Where there was bare grass, you'd go to bed, and if you turned over in the night, you'd find yourself bombing down the mountainside. So that was all we had for sleeping bags, and we walked up the hill a little ways there and found a game trail. It was all dug out in the hillside, and we figured we could make our paper sleeping bags lay in that game trail, so we got in and went to bed. Well, that dang trail must have been the trail to water for whatever was up there. I don't know. It was big animals, anyway. I imagine elk and maybe sheep or goats, deer, whatever. But that must have been the thoroughfare for those animals, that game trail where we had our beds. Because all night long you'd hear the footsteps, and they'd plonk, 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 and they'd just get so close that you know they had to be gonna step right on you. And then they'd smell you or something, and there'd be a big snort and a bunch of crashing, and then you'd think, I'm gonna go to sleep. Just about the time you'd start to go to sleep, you'd hear this thud, 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 and another one had come, and it went on the entire night. I don't think we really ever went to sleep. There were animals crashing through the brush the whole night. Then the next day we walked out, and that was the day before the Mangoch fire. When we got out, they told us that all these guys had been killed over there, and of course nobody knew who. We were pretty worried. I had a brother jumping, and I didn't know where he was. I didn't know whether he was a Mangoch or where. We didn't know clear till the next day when I got back to Missoula who was actually involved in it. I'd say that was my most memorable fire, just because so many things happened.
Okay. I was going to ask you about the Mangoch fire, and I was... did that seem to affect the attitudes of the jumpers?
I don't think so. It came pretty close to the end of the season. Really, there weren't very many more fire jumps after the Mangoch fire, so I wasn't around a lot longer. A few weeks, all right. But it seemed to me that the people were more inflamed or worked up about the Mangoch fire from outside the Jumper Project than from within it. It seemed like everybody in there, everybody knew that fighting fire was pretty dangerous. And we had some bad luck. It was pretty bad luck, but I don't think anybody had any particularly bad feeling about it. Of course, everybody lost a bunch of good friends. That was just no different than wartime. Most of us had just gotten out of the service, so I think that maybe had a little effect too among the jumpers, because I'd say practically everybody in the jumpers was a veteran. And you'd been through the same thing just a couple of years before, and it wasn't like it would be now if the same thing happened.
That's pretty interesting. Do you have any other stories that you can remember?
Lots of stories, but most of them weren't true. They were probably true the first time they were told. After a story goes around a while, it doesn't resemble the original incident too much. There are lots of good stories of things that happened, gentlemen, but none ever happened to me. My life in the jumpers was pretty common. I didn't have any of those hair-raising experiences that some of them did.
Well, how did being a smoke jumper affect your career choices later?
As directly affecting it, nothing. You know, you learned a lot of things in the jumpers, but when I graduated from college, I went off as an electrical engineer, and there was really never anything directly that a person did in the jumpers that affected what you did throughout your life. But indirectly, I'm sure it did. You learn to deal with situations without having to go to somebody to ask them what to do, because you'd gotten in the habit of just being self-sufficient in the jumpers, and I think probably things like that affected you. And just the fact that it was always an interesting conversation piece. Anybody that had been in the jumpers had people always wanted to talk about it. It was nice to have been a jumper. It wasn't the sort of thing I really wanted to have made a career out of. But it was really fun to have been a jumper. But I don't think it really made very much difference in a person's choice of a career.
Is there anything else you can think of that you might like to share with us?
I don't know. I guess not. I suspect that the attitude in the jumpers now, the few that I've known in recent years, is quite a bit different than it was then. But that's... the jumpers are quite a bit different organization than they were then, too. It's gotten to be a time of where it isn't just a bunch of college kids, and it's more people that do that for a living now. And at the time I was jumping, it was still we still called it the Jumper Project. It was a sort of an experimental thing, and it hadn't really ever been accepted, I guess, as a sure thing at the time we were there. So it was still you felt that you were working on a kind of an experimental project to see if it would work. And that isn't the case now. It's been in existence so long that it's just like any other job in the Forest Service. It's just a job to be done, and that's bound to affect the attitude of the jumpers. I don't really know hardly anybody out there now. I've known people down through the years. So I can't really compare to say they're a lot different than they were then. But I suspect they're just due to the change in the makeup of the people, of the crews, that they probably have quite a bit different attitude. I'm sure just from reading these things in the paper about all the comments in the paper about them trying to move jumpers out to a bunch of locations scattered around the state instead of moving or keeping the main headquarters here. And there's a lot of disagreement with that idea by the people that are jumping, just from the letters to the editor and so forth and so on. That would have never entered anybody's mind at the time I was jumping. I wouldn't care where you jumped on. I can't imagine anybody caring whether they jumped out of Missoula or Cedar Lake or where. That wasn't even a consideration.
Well, I'd sure like to thank you for this interview.
You're welcome.